Welcome, listeners, to the Film Club, or rather Film Club. Again, I've put the prefix on. I don't know why I keep doing that. Welcome to Film Club. You can add a the if you want. It's entirely up to you. This is episode 14. I am Mal Foster, joined, as always, by my co-pilot, Mr. Dan Seraph. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Mal?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good indeed. We are talking this week about your last pick, which was the 1948 film Bicycle Thieves, or Bicycle Thief, or The Bicycle Thieves, or however you want to put it. Hopefully everyone listening has already watched it. If you haven't yet, you, as always, might want to put this on pause, because there will most likely be some big spoilers abound, as there is each episode. So yeah, if you haven't got around to checking it out yet, put this on pause, go watch it, come back, and then you can join in the discussion with us. But why not just give us a little summary of what Bicycle Thieves is, and in particular, why you picked this film?
The reason I picked this film is because I felt, after having a little spurt of obscure, weird films, I thought it was about time that we picked a film that was a kind of bona fide classic, you know, a film that has been so influential throughout the history of cinema. And I can't think of a film that's more influential than this, The Bicycle Thieves, because I think it's a film that really started a lot of movements. I think the kind of American independent film movement is so indebted to The Bicycle Thieves. I think kind of British social realism cinema, like we talked about Fish Tank, I think that's so indebted to The Bicycle Thieves. A lot of what it does in terms of its location shooting and using non-actors and kind of getting down and kind of onto the streets to make a film, you know, in contrast to the kind of extravagant sets and the huge budgets that Hollywood were using in the likes of Gone with the Wind and so on. It's just a really important, influential film in cinema. And I mean, as well as that, it's a great film as well, in my opinion, at least. You know, I think it's got a really simple but really captivating little story, great performances from all the non-actors, and I think it's just really, really beautifully made too. So that's basically, in a nutshell, why I chose The Bicycle Thieves.
Excellent. Well, this is the first time I've seen it. In fact, if you listen to the last episode, I had no idea what this film was. I'd never heard of it until Dan suggested it for his latest pick. So I was, as always am, when a film arrives that I've not seen or even heard of, lands in front of me for Film Club, I always get a little bit extra excited because it's all new territory. So this was my first time viewing it, and I really liked it. I can see why you picked it, and I can see why it is very inspirational, and I like the fact that it is very grounded. You can see a lot of influence, as you say, on American indie film, but also like British kitchen sink dramas from like the 60s and such. Just that very grounded, down to earth feel about it. But it's also very understated and emotional in a very understated manner. Like, the film actually has moments of real joy and disheartened desperation at points, and it's done in such a wonderfully simple and subtle manner. That I think it makes more of an impact because it is done so subtly.
It is. I was actually, I have in my notes written in front of me that this is sort of kind of a masterpiece in subtlety, because it does so many simple, very understated little things, but they have such a, they carry such like an emotional weight. One of the most powerful moments in the film for me, it's just like a fleeting moment, but it's a scene when they're giving away the bed linens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the film, in order to buy a bicycle, and because they've just like, but when they go to this place, I mean, I don't really know what kind of place it is that buys bed linens. It's just like stacked, like it's like a factory of bed linens behind them, of people that have clearly, obviously, just given them away, sacrificing all the comfort that they have in order to put food on the table, and maybe, you know, in the same shoes as our main character, who is doing this in order to have sustainable work. And it's such a little simple thing, you know, a stack of bed linens, but it does carry such like a powerful weight to it. And the film does this a lot, you know, it does a lot of very subtle, simple things, but they are very powerful.
It does. It's almost like, there's a few moments like that. I'm glad you picked that moment out, because that struck me as well. But it's, what's wonderful about this film is that it picks one story from what is essentially hundreds of stories, because this is taking place after the Second World War Italy, where it's in ruins, and you actually see some of the locations. It's not the Rome that you you kind of see in more modern cinema or 70s and 80s films in which it was more glamorized. It's very gritty, it's very dirty looking, and it's very sort of grounded down to represent, you know, the fiscal and emotional times of the year, of the era, sorry, of Italy at that point. And it's literally like Antonio's story is just one of hundreds, and you see that. And with the bed linen thing that you mentioned, literally, there's so many people in this same boat of desperation, and that's the wonderful thing about this film. Not that I like people being in desperation, but just the fact that it is very reflective of that time. And that alone shows just how many people are having to, as you say, give up their comfort just to put food on the table.
Yeah, I mean, as Antonio kind of goes in search of his bicycle when it's stolen, him and his little boy, I mean, you do get to see a glimpse at a lot of different people's lives. You know, they kind of do drift in and out of people's lives. They're all kind of going on the same path. You know, they're all looking for work. They're all trying to put food on the table. They're all kind of searching for hope and meaning in the same way that he is. And you kind of like just weave in and out of these people's lives throughout the story. And it really does capture so well, you know, this country, like in post-World War II, just really kind of financially downtrodden and economically, you know, like just so poor and so kind of impoverished, you know. But like it's not a bleak film either, though. Like that's what I like about The Bicycle Thieves. It's not, you know, it's not like poverty porn, like that's the phrase you describe some like films, you know, that just kind of wallow in, you know, the kind of self-pity and things like that. But there's so much kind of hope and kind of beauty in Bicycle Thieves as well. Like you mentioned before, how warm it can be at times, and there are moments of humour. And I think overall, by the time you get to the end of the film, you know, there's a lot of kind of light at the end of the tunnel, even though it is a very tragic story and a very tragic ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does that good thing because it concentrates on the one story as a central focus, and it kind of touches on other people as well, as you said, through the film. But it never kind of wallows in its own self-pity. It's never a case of, oh, poor Antonio, he's all alone in this tragic world kind of thing. In fact, it does this really interesting thing, is one of the first shots you see of him, he is sat on his own, away from the group of people looking for work at like the employment office or whatever it may be, and they're all huddled in a big herd and he's on his own. So he kind of, you get the instinct that he has this perspective that he is not selfish at all, but he kind of maybe sees his situation as only his situation, as unique. And as he goes through the film, and obviously he's upset with whoever stole his bike, but he begins to kind of understand that it's not just him that's affected by what's going on, it's everybody. And the final shot you get in the film is him blending into a crowd of people and becoming camouflaged amongst them. And I think that is actually really telling of not just his mind state, but I think of a lot of people's mind states back then and just the whole situation.
I've never noticed that before, actually. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to pick that up because it's a journey that Antonio does make over the film. You know, he does kind of selfishly look out for himself and his family. I guess that's not selfish at all. I mean, No. It's kind of cool, really.
It's realistic, but, you know, it's obviously from his point of view, as anybody would do. You know, everybody in their own right, although it's not acting selfishly. You are concentrating on your needs and those around you.
Exactly. I mean, these are really tough times. And like in any kind of tough times, you know, you do kind of put you and your family before anyone else. Like, it's not selfish at all, to be honest. Yeah, a really wrong word for me to use. But I think over the film, he does kind of take this journey in realizing, you know, that everybody is on kind of a similar path as him. And I think that's telling as well, the fact that the film kind of, as well as being about, you know, struggling, people kind of struggling through this era, it is kind of a film about community as well. You know, at the end of the film, the kind of rabble kind of forgive Antonio when he tries to steal the bike at the end of the film because of his boy. You know, he's in tears and he's going to lose his father if he's kind of thrown away in prison. Kind of, I mean, at the end of the film, family in spite of everything that's happened. There's a kind of real kind of community spirit to the film. It is kind of reflected in those first and last shots, which I've never really noticed before.
I'm glad you brought up the song, because I wanted to bring him up. I think he is pretty integral to the film, because it's interesting to see how their relationship is tested through this journey. And the thing is, it's weird, because those who haven't seen it, and when you first hear about it, it's literally a film about a man looking for a bicycle that's been stolen. You know, your first impression might be to think, oh God, how dull. You know, is that it? But it's actually so much more than that, and it's because of the subtleties, and it's because of the ever slowly, slightly changing dynamics within the film, and there's a great deal of symbolism, which I'll get onto in a bit, but the thing that really struck a chord with me was his relationship with his son. It's tested at points, and he gets frustrated. Both parties get frustrated with each other, but ultimately it strengthens their relationship, and that seems to me almost symbolic of, you know, when times are tough, people bond together and actually become closer.
Yeah, exactly. I go back to the point you just said as well about, you know, a lot of people would look at this film and think, you know, it's just a guy going after a bike. there's a scene in the police station just after he loses his bike, just after it's stolen from him, and the police kind of respond to his, like, you know, his request for them to go and find, like, the thief and find the criminal. The police respond by saying, look for it yourself, it's only a bike. And that's kind of, you know, that it's only a bike thing is kind of representative, like, of us as audiences, you know, watching this film, kind of thinking, like, what's the big deal about this guy looking for a bike? Who cares? But the film really does make you care. Like, it really kind of, the almost kind of life or death stakes, you know, this guy won't have work without this bike. This guy won't be able to put food on his table without his bike. This guy won't be able to support his family without his bike. And so it's such like a simple thing, this bike, but it becomes such an integral part of, you know, this family's kind of well-being. And the fact that it kind of manages to do that, and it makes you kind of see how the slightest of privileges are so important in times of this extremity, I think that's just a really great thing that the film does, that it manages to do that.
The bike, I have to say, a lot of people will just probably think, oh, this is daft, and it is just a bike. But to me, it's more than a bike. It's literally a symbol of hope. And I wrote in my notes that a seeds for a better future. Because if he can get his bike back and he can get good at his job, he could then develop further in a career and actually have a steady income and a wage and actually make his life better for his children and his wife. So it's not just a bike he's hunting down, it's the prospects of a better future. And I think it's a really telling scene when he's looking around the market and he's looking for all the different bits. It's almost like his future's been dissected and broken into bits, and he's trying to put it back together again somehow.
Exactly. I mean, this film is as much a search about kind of a search for kind of hope and meaning as much as it is a search for a bike. And there's kind of, there are symbols and metaphors that hint towards that even early on. You know, you have a great scene in a church, for example, and some religious imagery in there, which kind of, it provides this kind of metaphor for the search for meaning. And there's the scene with the fortune teller as well. So you have these kind of early things that point towards that all the way through, you know, that this isn't just about, you know, one man searching for his bike. It's about this whole kind of community of people, almost this whole nation of people, really, kind of looking for hope. So it is, it's a very emotional aspect of the film.
I think the fortune teller is an interesting point, because it kind of shows how people adapt, whether or not they want to, or they kind of, you know, they bend their perceptions of stuff. Because when he first encounters the fortune teller, when his wife goes to pay her money, he's kind of like, would she know, silly old crow, she can't tell the future, you know. And then yet he finds himself, after he's exhausted pretty much every opportunity and every idea, he finds himself going there. And it's kind of a little bit of a statement on faith. Now, whether you want to take that as just faith in general, or you want to tie it in with the religious elements, I found that quite interesting.
Yeah, it's this, I mean, it's a really great way for the film to, I guess, make you care a lot more about these characters as well. You know, these aren't, as we said before, these aren't characters kind of wallowing in pity. You know, these are people who have, like, a genuine sense of, like, hope and faith, you know, working for a better future. And I think that's, it's just kind of a really, it's a really way, a good way of telling this story. You know, you could very easily have told this kind of just a story of, you know, people suffering, desperate, and, you know, going through just hardship after hardship after hardship. But I think little elements like that really kind of excel the film above, you know, other pieces of social realism, even though this is the kind of the first piece of social realism. But it kind of really kind of set a bar high because it really just captured so well, you know, this kind of spirit within a community, you know, really kind of building towards like a brighter future for themselves and their families.
From a filmmaking perspective, I think it's actually a really important film, having watched it, and I kind of take in how it's took on so much inspiration for other people, in terms of the fact that, you know, I'm a big believer that less is often more, and you see so much in more glamorized, more financially backed productions these days, where to really kind of get a sense of empathy, sympathy, or even project a sense of hope, you need to invest much more production value. And yes, it works to a certain degree, and I know this is a weird analogy, but you look at something like Rocky and you see how much the score builds into creating a sense of hope, how much the actual camera work builds into a sense of hope, and how much time and money is ploughed into that sense of aspiration. Yet you get a real sense of hope and aspiration and empathy and sympathy from such simple things as handing in bed linen, actually getting a bicycle. I know it sounds crazy, but when he gets his bicycle back, there is a moment of just sheer joy, because you're like, even though you haven't spent much time with the character, like, you can totally understand where he's coming from, his sort of plight, what he wants to try and achieve. And he gets his bike back and you're just like, yeah, even though you know he's going to be stolen at some point, there's like a spark of joy. And it's done through such real, grounded realism. And it's wonderful. And it shows that you don't necessarily have to have all the money in the world and production value behind you to make something that can stir emotions.
No, absolutely not. And that's why I think this is a really important film, because I think it was one of, if not the first, to kind of do that, you know, to kind of show that you don't need a huge set, you don't need A-list actors or actresses, you don't need like a director with a huge visual flair, though I do think the visuals in this film are incredible. All you really need is kind of a great story and really likable characters, and, you know, you're just a really kind of talented crew of people working behind you to tell a really great, relatable, important story. And that's why I think this is a film that, even in if it's just indirectly, has influenced so many films. I mean, we talked about Slacker like a few weeks ago on Film Club, and I think even a way it kind of can relate to that, because, you know, that's a film that was made on a low budget, with just kind of a novel idea, with like no particularly at the time any big name actors or any you know, huge sets or anything like that. It was just kind of set on the streets of Austin. And, you know, this is a film that did that, albeit, 30, 40 years, even more earlier. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you. I think it's one of the most important films ever made, in my opinion.
You mentioned the way it looks. I actually think it looks really nice for a film of this era, which, you know, obviously doesn't have as much panache as more contemporary stuff, but there's a series of shots which I like. It encompasses a really nice sort of eclectic combination of different angles, from wide angles and closer shots, and I think it actually helps sort of pull the sense of isolation that maybe he feels, you know, the sense of desperation, and also kind of the inclusion of the community. And I think it's just very, again, very simple, subtle techniques that sort of twist and tighten these themes. And I just think it just, the way it's chopped up and put together is actually really nice. And it looks visually engaging. You know, it's never just one camera just roaming from one point to another.
No, but there is a lot of kind of low budget aesthetics in the film. Like, I don't know if my DVD copy of it's quite old. Well, I watched it, so it's kind of grainy, and, you know, there are kind of flickers of where, like, the film's probably been damaged over years before the transfers. But I kind of like that about the film, you know, it just this kind of vintage quality about it. And that's the kind of thing about the film, you know, this is such a contrast from Hollywood filmmaking. And I don't know if it was intentional of Vittorio De Sica to do that, to create such a stark contrast. If it was, though, I think it does a really great job of it, because it is kind of very gritty in the way it's made, but it is beautiful as well. Like, you mentioned a lot of the camera work and the shots, they are, and some of the wide angles. I mean, it is, you know, this isn't just some guy with a camera roaming the streets of Rome.
Roaming Rome?
No, I didn't realize that. Sounded.
That was its alternative title in Europe.
But like guy that obviously really knows how to shoot a film, you know, he can create such beauty out of, you know. There's a shot in the film that I really like, and it doesn't really mean a lot. It's only kind of not a throwaway moment, but it's just kind of a moment that can connect scenes. But of kind of this wave of people riding a bicycle like through
Yes.
road,
I know
but
exactly what you mean.
kind of up and kind of pans across as you see them riding bicycles through. It's a really like beautiful scene. It just a lot of little kind of poetic moments like that. They just, I mean, it's got a real kind of. It's not got a visual flair to it, but there is a real kind of craftsmanship in the filmmaking.
There's something that I thought was quite interesting, and it's like a slight deviation the film takes. It's almost like a little look at the class system of the times, where Antonio takes his son Bruno for dinner, and they order, and I mean, I don't know like the moral compass of his father, but he gives his son wine, but he orders like a liter of wine and 2 bits of bread and mozzarella, and it's almost like it's like a gourmet treat for them. And then you see the little boy Bruno like looking over his shoulder, and you see the rich family with what seems to be champagne and fancy food, and it kind of just keeps trotting back and forth, just flicking between the two, the little boys looking at each other. And I just thought that was a really interesting sort of reflective moment of the class and society system.
Yeah, I think the class system, again, it's very subtly done, but it definitely is there if you want to look under the surface. And going back to that scene with the police before, I mean, you know, these are people that don't really care
No.
about poor and disadvantaged. And I think that's sort of a statement on Italy as a whole at this time, you know. These are people who have very clearly been abandoned and don't have help. They don't have any kind of welfare or benefits, you know, to keep them and their families kind of safe and, you know, nourished and, you know, and just kind of living within well means at this time. And again, it's very subtly done, but I definitely do think there's a kind of class system that's making a statement about in some way.
I think going to the police thing, I think that is actually a really interesting scene as well, because it's clearly there's just a sheer lack of care. Like it is literally, like you said, go out and look for it yourself. And he even brushes him off with sarcasm at one point, saying, "Oh yeah, that's right, because we're going to send out the flying squad looking for your bicycle."
It is. It's really interesting. It just kind of, I mean, again, it's a weird kind of contrast to me, you know, with like Rocky and the bicycle thing. Again, it's the same weird comparison. But I also kind of think that City of God reminds me of this film in a way. Much better than City of God, in my opinion, though I do like it. Because, you know, that is a glimpse at a kind of Brazilian slum that's kind of been abandoned, you know, that's kind of been, it's not the picture kind of postcard image of Rome and so, sorry, of Rio de Janeiro. So, you know, this slum, the City of God, has been kind of left by the wayside. It's been abandoned. You know, the people who are in charge of the country don't care. And I think that's an issue that's handled in the same way here. And I think scenes like you mentioned in the restaurant and scenes with the police, I think, touch on that, albeit in a very nuanced way, but definitely touch on, you know, this kind of society that feels kind of abandoned.
Yeah, definitely. And one that's left to basically fend for itself. And you see the products of that. You see how many people are sort of queuing outside of the employment office and just how desperate people are for work. And, you know, you see just how soft the sort of moral barometer kind of melts at points, you know, because obviously Antonio's outraged that someone stole his bicycle and he can't understand why. Until, you know, he's exhausted all of his resources and sees an opportunity, and it literally kind of it doesn't neither condemns nor praises criminal behavior, but it kind of goes, it happens, or it happened, you know, and here's why.
People just have to do it because of the situation they're in. I mean, like I said, you see that at the end of the film when Antonio is in such a desperate position that he tries to like steal the bike at the end of the film.
And I mean, it says it's a wonderful thing to say that a film can actually reach such a moral sort of villainous point and make a profound statement just by someone stealing a bicycle. It's something like an extra would do in an action film now. But yeah, even now you can look at it within the context and the whole framing of the film, and it actually is just a standout moment, and you're just like, wow, And it does, that's a wonderful thing about Bicycle Thief that I really liked, is that it does these little subtle things and it makes an impact like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said before, I do think this is a kind of masterpiece in subtlety because everything that's there in a film, literally everything from the visuals to the performances to the story to its kind of meanings and metaphors, like everything is so nuanced and so subtly done. It's just a real slice of everyday life, post World War II Italy. And I don't know what it would have been like for people living at this time. If, I mean, I guess they would never have a chance to see this film if they were in such poverty, but. I guess, I mean, it must just been so refreshing for them to see, their own lives kind of reflect on the screen. And I think it's refreshing, even still today, to see such a real, like, honest film made, especially at a time like this in 1940s when, pictures are very quintessentially extravagant and, very glamorous. But I just think it's a really great, honest, realistic film that at the same time just has so much beauty about it. And so much to say as well about living in these kind of conditions.
Exactly. I don't think I could say any more about it than that. I think you've encapsulated everything about the film wonderfully in that there. Do you have anything else you want to go on about?
Not particularly, but I hope they have seen this film before listening to our podcast.
Yes, because there's been a major spoiler. He steals the bike.
But I hope this has kind of spurred you on to go and see it because I do think that this is, if you're looking in terms of kind of cinema history, I think that this is such an important landmark, it's such an important milestone, I guess, in cinema history. And it still stands up today, in my opinion. I think this is a film that will still remain relevant for many, many years to come. I can't see it ever not being relevant because the themes that it touch on are so universal and will always be there, themes of, poverty and family and things. So yeah, I just think it's a great film, really important, and I'm glad that you enjoyed it too.
I really did enjoy it, and I'm really pleased I've seen it. That's the wonderful thing about doing this whole podcast is that it gives not just me and you, but it gives everybody else an opportunity to see stuff that they may never have even. Well, like I said, I hadn't even heard of this, and had you not brought it up, there's a good chance I may have gone my whole life without seeing it. And I feel I'm a little bit richer in life experience for seeing it. So, yeah, I liked it a lot. And if you haven't seen it already, then why are you still listening? We told you to pause and go watch. So go do that. So there we go. Bicycle Thief, number 13 on our films list. We are amassing quite an eclectic collection. One that is going to expand a little bit further in a bit, but I'm going to drop you our trash bag masterpiece for this week. And it is the quintessential trash bag masterpiece. Some may say the innovating spark which formed the phrase so good, so bad even it's good. That's the wrong way around. So bad that it's good. I am talking about Ed Wood's phenomenal film, Plan 9 from Outer Space. Now, Ed Wood has been deemed for many years the worst director ever. Ever. Even worse than U-Ball. And this is his magnum opus of terribleness. It is, if you've never heard of it, go track it down. It's on YouTube. You can watch it in full for free on YouTube. And I can't even recommend it highly enough. It is terrible. It's got some really dodgy effects in it. It's got some horrendous acting, some terrible dialogue, but it is as enjoyable as hell. It's so weird. It's about zombies that come from outer space trying to take over the human race. It's Bela Lugosi's last film. Bela Lugosi died during, not during the making of it, but during the time it was filmed. And so he was replaced with another actor. And even though you can tell because the whole build, size, and shape of the actors are different, the way that Ed Wood tries to get away with this is having the replacement actor cover his face with a cape. Like literally holding it to his nose so you can only see the top of his head. And even then, he's going bald, and Bela Lugosi had a full head of hair when he filmed this. It is just trashy, it's wonderful. And it just really is the epitome of a trash bag masterpiece. Have you ever seen Plan 9 from Outer Space, Dan?
I have. I went around to my friend's house. It must have been about 2 years ago, and we were just so bored and we were like, let's watch Planet from Outer Space and see it. Like, and none of us had ever watched it. And it was hilarious. Like, we had such a good time watching it because I mean, it's just so shoddily and shambolically made. And I mean, the writing as well is just so bad. But I mean, it's so amusingly bad, which is the great thing about it. You know, it's not just frustrating to watch. It actually does prove to be a great laugh. I'm trying to remember what the line of dialogue is that kills me. I think it's really early on. I think it's something like, future events such as these will affect you in the future. It's like, clearly, future events, of course, affect you in the future. And there are little things like that that are just kind of so silly, but it is a really entertaining film, as bad as it is. I should say, like, I know neither of us are particularly big Tim Burton fans, but the film Ed Wood is a really good look at kind of almost the making of this film and the man behind the film. It's worth a watch if you're interested.
Exactly, there you go. If you want to do a double bill, go watch Planet Nine from Outer Space and then watch Ed Wood, which I would recommend on its own anyway, but do a double bill if you want to watch that and kind of get an insight. Because you get an insight into how Planet Nine was actually made and is
It's kind of sweet in a way, actually, like.
it's very sweet, it's very endearing, it's almost like a love letter to one of the most enthusiastic but ultimately flawed filmmakers of all time.
I mean, that's what's so good about it. I mean, it's just like a really well-intentioned film that went so horribly wrong because this guy just had like all the odds against him. He still kind of kept going, and like despite the fact he didn't have the budget or even the creativity or the intelligence to do it, he just went out and did it. And I think there's something kind of sweet and admirable under the surface about the Plan 9 that makes it so hard to hate, even when you've got like gravestones falling over
I
and.
know. Yeah, I do think, I think it's a lovely, endearing film, and I think it's endearing that the fact that he kept putting Bela Lugosi in his movies. You know, it's like everyone had given up on Bela Lugosi, and he's like, no, I still really like him. I know he's not a big star, but I still really like him. Let's have him in it. So there's a real sort of sweet, earnest feeling towards Ed Wood in general, and towards Plan 9. So there you go, that's your trash bag masterpiece for this week. A true quintessential schlocky golden film.
Half
However,
past.
your
Good
n
choice.
why thank you very much. Your next film, I was saying to Dan off air, I had my film for this pick already in the back. I'm not going to say what it was because I think I'm going to keep it for another date. But last week, I saw something which polarized me like no other film has ever done before.
Oh, it's not going to be another break in the waves.
Oh, Breaking the Waves was mild compared to this.
Oh, shit, really? Oh, my
You
gosh.
are really either going to embrace this and take it for all of its symbolic glory, or you're going to think, what the hell has he made me watch? It is a film from 1981, and it is directed by, I'm going to try and pronounce the guy's name, Andrzej Zlosky. It's a film called Possession, and it is a art house horror film, although it is marketed very heavily as just a straight out and out horror film. It's not. It's much more than that. I need to point out, as nitpicky as this may sound, I'm putting forth the European cut, the full cut version. The US version that was released in 81 was 90 minutes long. This is 2 hours long. The difference being, they took 30 minutes of material, which kind of just makes the edited down version look horrible, apparently, and just look like a straight out and out horror film. It is quite possibly the weirdest film I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
And to give you a quick sort of synopsis of Possession, without giving too much away, it stars a young Sam Neill, he of Jurassic Park, and Isabella Adjani, the bearer of Daniel Day-Lewis's seed, child, if you want to call them a child instead, in what is an utterly flawless, amazing performance. She won the Best Actress Award at Cannes for this film, but it has been slated and it has been praised in equal measures, and it is literally such a polarizing film. But anyway, a quick summary is, Isabella Adjani plays, oh, what's her name? Let me scroll down on the page. I should be able to remember this. She plays a woman called Anna, and she is married to Sam Neill's character, who is called Mark, who has been away on a prolonged business trip. And when he comes back from said prolonged business trip, he finds his wife is very different. She's isolated, she's very cold towards him, she's very cruel. And in fact, he finds that what he believed to be was a happy marriage is actually crumbling apart, and she wants a divorce. He finds out that she has been having an affair with a strangely flamboyant and proficient in martial arts German guy called Heinrich. And he thinks that's the source of why she wants a divorce. But as he digs deeper, he finds that she's been keeping a very bizarre secret in a dirty apartment building. And all I will say, without giving too much away, is that her secret was created by Carlos Rambaldi, the man that made E.T.
Right. I took a quick look at IMDb because I'd never heard this film before, actually. And I was just kind of scanning through, and I found the frequently asked questions section, and the first question is, what did I just see?
Yes, exactly. And that is the first question you will ask yourself. Whether or not that's a good question or a bad question remains to be answered. But I picked Possession because the thing is, there's moments in it which are horrible, and there's some really bad overacting. And I still don't know if it's done on purpose to aggravate the idea of being out of your mind and out of body, if it's done purposely to aggravate that sense and that theme that runs through the film, or if it's just really bad acting. I can't actually quite tell. It has one of the most unnerving scenes I've ever seen in my life. It has a suicide attempt by an electric bread knife. It has all kinds of weird, weird stuff going on. But if you're a fan of a plot, and a plot is essential in a film to you, it's maybe not the best film to be sitting down and joining us with, because the plot is loose. It's there, but it's loose, and it's more powerful in its symbolic state. There's a lot of metaphors, there's a lot of visual twists, there's a lot of sort of subtext within the film. I still don't know if I like it myself or if I really dislike it, hence why I wanted to watch it again, and I thought, well, if I'm going to watch it again, let's all watch it together, and then we can discuss, probably for hours length, what we've all just seen.
Right, okay. I'm interested. I like being challenged by a film, so I'm interested to see this.
It is very challenging, and I'm very interested to see what you think of it, and I'm very interested to hear what our listeners think of it as well. As I said, it's called Possession, 1981. I'm just stating the date because there's obviously, since then, been a few films with the word possession in it. Directed by Andrzej Zulowski, I believe that's his name, I'm probably butchering it to hell, and starring Isabel Adjani and Sam Neill. I'm going to put a trailer in the show notes so you can go check it out, and I'll put the IMDb link in there as well for you to go check out as well. But yeah, just brace yourself, because it's certainly an experience.
Mm.
Whether or not it's an experience you like or you loathe, we'll find out in 2 weeks' time, but it's there nonetheless. But it's just, it's going to be very testing. I thought Breaking the Waves was going to be a test, and it was very much so. This may just be the ultimate test in cinematic history, I don't know. It's very odd, but powerful and engaging and all kinds of things. It's a very mixed bag, so it'd be interesting to get some feedback in a couple of weeks from that.
All right.
Yeah, there you go.
And where can people give feedback?
That is a good question and a wonderful link. See, so slick and so professional on this show. You can give feedback by joining up. You don't even have to join up. If you have a Facebook account, you can go to Facebook Screen Invasion and look for our Film Club forum. We're also on Twitter as well at Invasion Radio. Or if you want to send us an email with your feedback towards this film or any other film that you've seen thus far with us along our journey, you can send us an email at filmclub@gmx.com. Simple as. All of those links will be put in the show notes as well at screeninvasion.com, so it's probably going to be easier just to go there. And yeah, so that's it. That's the next film set up. And it's going to be interesting to one, watch it again, and come back and talk about it. So there you go. That is it. Possession, that is the end of episode 14. Go watch, enjoy, and let us know what you think of it, and we'll see you here again in 2 weeks' time. But for now, that's it.